This is WMUK's West Southwest. Legend has it that Orson Welles scared more than just the pants off an anxious nation with his 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast. But Michigan historian and author A. Brad Schwartz says there's more to the story. He spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins about the continuing legacy of the most famous radio show in the nation's history.
It has gone down in legend as the broadcast that panicked America and sent people screaming into the streets in terror, but that legend isn't exactly reality, is it?
Not exactly. It wasn't completely fabricated. There's a significant element of truth in the myth, but the day after the show, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into, America's journalists blew it all out of proportion, as they are wont to do even today. So from this rather small, kind of isolated, scattered phenomenon of people being frightened, you get the pop culture legend of a great mass of people, you know, piling the kids in the car, grabbing the shotgun and getting out of town. Though having said that, I was just giving a talk on War of the Worlds in New Jersey, not far from where the Martians are supposed to have landed in the show. And a woman came up to me after and said, she was older, and said, "I just wanted to tell you, I remember my father, we were living in New York, and my father grabbing us and getting us in the car so we could flee." And so it did happen. It happened rather rarely.
And you've also written that the people who were listening to the show back in 1938, they didn't just sort of blindly, you know, hear the broadcast and then, you know, run out into the street. They actually tried to verify the information.
In many cases, yeah. And that's part of what the journalists mistook for panic. Today, if we heard something come over the TV or the radio about some kind of disaster and we weren't sure exactly what it was, I think our first impulse in most cases would be to grab our smartphones and go on Google News or something and see if we could verify it. They couldn't do that in 1938, obviously. So what they did in a lot of cases was to pick up the phone and to call a local newspaper office, to call the radio station itself, or to call the police. Because the show was about this alien invasion, a lot of people tend to assume that most people who believe it to be true believe that the aliens were invading. But the best evidence we have suggests that the majority gave it some other explanation. They thought this was some kind of natural disaster, or they thought, perhaps quite reasonably, because this is 1938 again, that the Nazis were invading, or it was some kind of military thing like that.
It's probably worth mentioning that the War of the Worlds broadcast was part of the Mercury Theater on the Air series on CBS. It actually was a fairly low-rated program, and in fact, that night was up against the Chase and Sanborn Radio Hour on NBC, starring Edgar Bergen and his wooden friend Charlie McCarthy.
And if you can tell me how a ventriloquist act would work on the radio, please explain it to me, because I still haven't figured that one out after all the time I've spent studying this. But yeah, Welles' show was what they called back in those days a sustaining show, which is when a radio network like CBS had an hour of time where they couldn't sell advertising, because it was opposite, as you said, this really popular show. Nobody wanted to buy the advertising time, so they would give it away for a public interest purpose. This was part of, back in those days, there was a great movement to have a larger government hand in broadcasting, to turn all broadcasting almost into the American equivalent of the BBC, for example, and to make sure that the programming was not just entertaining, but also educational or uplifting in some way. So to forestall that, the radio networks would take time where they couldn't sell advertising and give it to people like Orson Welles or to symphony orchestras or to news. You know, news back in those days was not, for the most part, paid for by commercials. And so Welles gets this hour of time. Supposedly, you know, the idea of the show was to dramatize classic works of literature, but he could do pretty much whatever he wanted, and he didn't have a very large audience, so, you know, he didn't feel the need to appeal to the lowest common denominator, as many radio shows at the time often did, and so he could do really inventive and experimental things. And with War of the Worlds, that show, kind of rather unusually for the series, didn't begin with a book, but it began with this idea of wanting to do a, in Wells's mind, a radio show that sounded like a crisis that was actually happening. Because this is right after the famous, Munich diplomatic crisis, when Hitler takes Czechoslovakia and the British appease him, and you know they say we've achieved peace with honor, peace in our time, but it won't last for more than a year. And as that had been going on, and as this diplomatic incident had pushed the world as close as it had come since 1919 to World War, the American radio networks reported every bulletin and broke into to regularly scheduled programming all the time to give these updates, and the country was on the edge of its seat. And Wells, one of the shows they interrupted was an episode of the Mercury Theater on the Air. So Wells had been observing this, and he knew how effective, how dramatic and gripping these new radio news flashes were, and he wanted to do something like that in a show. And so he needed a book, and he discussed it with a couple of his collaborators, and one of them suggested The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. It's unclear whether Orson Welles had actually read the novel. His producer, John Houseman, thought he hadn't, but he loved the idea, and so turned it over to Howard Koch, his writer on these shows, who then crafted a script that went through several revisions, because nobody in the Mercury really particularly liked the book or particularly liked the script. They thought it was silly, that this Martian invasion plot was 40 years old by that time, and it was kind of seen as kid stuff. And they thought, you know, listeners who had come to expect stuff like Shakespeare from the Mercury Theater on the Air would just twirl the dial and get out of it, because they thought this was too silly. So they kept adding elements to the show to make it more realistic, to make it more engaging, without realizing how well they might succeed. So by accident, they created this show that was much more terrifying than I think any of them had anticipated.
The Wells broadcast had precursors that you write about in the book, including a very popular show of the time called The March of Time, which covered events, current events of the week. But because of the technological limitations of the time, they had to reenact them in the studio. And here we're getting into the aspect of fake news. I believe someone famously said of The March of Time that it was fakery and allegiance to the truth. How does that relate to this?
Well, it wasn't a technical limitation. They had the tools and the technology to record events, but it was a policy that was put down by the networks, because there was this fear that listeners had come to expect that whatever they heard over the radio was happening live. And if you were to air a recording of something, listeners would believe that that event was happening right at the moment, even though it wasn't. But as you said, the way the networks got around this kind of self-imposed prohibition was to reenact news events in a studio with actors and music and sound effects, and have people impersonate the President of the United States or Amelia Earhart or whoever it was. And this was somehow seen as more authentic, even though the content of the program was totally fake. And The March of Time, you know, we talk about it as a news program. It actually wasn't. It was technically an advertisement for Time magazine. They would dramatize the stories that you would read in that week's issue of Time.
What kind of parallels do you think there are between the world of 1938 and broadcasting then and our news environment today?
There are quite a few similarities. And this is just a basic truth about journalism in all eras, but the need to get attention, whether in 1938 you're selling newspapers or getting listeners, or today, whether you're agitating online, trying to grab people's eyeballs so they'll click on your link. You know, in 1938, a big part of why this sort of panic story that's still with us today gets exaggerated and gets twisted out of all resemblance to the truth is because of this economic need that newspapers have to sell more newspapers. You know, in those days, nothing would be more startling than a major, massive headline on your daily newspaper about Martians and panic. And so journalists, without really bothering to check their facts or to do follow-up reporting, printed these exaggerated, embellished stories about how the nation had succumbed to panic during this hour-long show. And I think there's a real parallel today to the way you might see on a cable news channel or an online news source, you know, how you might see a story twisted or the crisis element, the conflict of it, element of it, front-loaded so that that's the headline you see. And if you spend any time on Twitter, you know, the way, and you, if you follow news organizations, the way they'll ask a question or pose a startling statement just so you'll click on it, almost can't resist, because that's how they make their money from advertising. So that element of it, I think, is perennially with us. But also at that time, you know, broadcasting, news broadcasting, was still a very new thing in 1938. In the United States, it had only really begun for real in about 1932 with the Lindbergh kidnapping. There had been some precursors to that, but that was when broadcast journalism as we know it really, really began. And the newspapers, as kind of the more established media, you know, people have been saying newspapers are dying for decades. They were saying it back in the 1930s because newspapers had to account for this new technology that was much faster than they were, that could, you know, would always scoop them on a story, just as with today, you know, newspapers and also television are dealing with a new medium, the internet in this case, that has changed their business and threatened their livelihood in a lot of cases. And the response was very similar in 1938 or in the 1930s and today, which is where the more established medium eventually decided if you can't beat them, join them. So you would see in the 30s newspapers buying radio stations or establishing radio stations and using them to promote themselves. Today, you know, you see a lot of news organizations using Twitter, using Facebook to try and engage with listeners. You know, like they always say, like us on Facebook, or when they read tweets on the air, which is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. So that kind of aspect, you know, that need to account for this new technology and the effect it has on speeding up the news, on changing how it's reported, you know, it shortens the attention span, it quickens the news cycle, it front loads certain types of stories, more shocking types of stories in many cases, over others. And so that has a definite impact on how you get news. It happened in 1938. I think it's happening in a much more extreme sense today.
A. Brad Schwartz is the author of the book Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News. He spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. You can hear more of the interview at WMUK.org. Schwartz will talk about the legacy of the 1938 broadcast tonight as part of the South Haven Speakers Series. He'll be at the Lake Michigan College campus in South Haven at 6:30. Admission costs $10. You'll find more information through a link on our webpage. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.